It's the Burt Cohen Show. Have always been on the side of the underdog for freedom from repression and colonialism, right? Well, I guess there have been a few exceptions to that. And one of the issues that's going on right now is a flotilla, the second such flotilla, of aid to Gaza, the people in Gaza who have had a rather difficult time in recent years, the Palestinians there. And according to our guest today, the Obama administration appears to have given, believe it or not, a green light to an Israeli attack on this unarmed flotilla carrying peace and human rights activists, including a vessel with 50 Americans on board, bound for that besieged Gaza Strip. My guest today on the Burt Cohen Show is Stephen Zunis, professor of politics and chair of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco, and he serves as contributing editor of Tikkun magazine. Stephen, thank you very much for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show today. And Israel, let's face it, earned some bad press last year when Israeli Navy troops assaulted the Mavi Marmara, in which 9 passengers were killed, several dozen passengers, and 7 Israeli Defense Force commandos were injured when 6 ships of the Gaza Freedom Flotilla on the 31st of May 2010 was in international waters on the Mediterranean Sea. There was widespread international condemnation of the raid, and Israel-Turkey relations were strained very severely. Israel subsequently eased its blockade of Gaza because of the bad publicity, and this year, it's happening again, except it does seem that Israel learned some lessons. The U.S. ship this year is the Audacity of Hope, which is obviously named after those famous words by our president, Barack Obama. And there are 50 Americans, well, there are 50 passengers, many Americans, 5 members of the crew, and 11 journalists. Now, Stephen, the flotilla was supposed to have left its ports in Greece by now. There is some suspected sabotage. What, to the best of your knowledge, Professor Zunis, is going on? Why has the flotilla not moved? Has Israel just gotten smarter and taken preemptive strikes?
Well, actually, there are about a dozen ships that were scheduled to depart from a number of countries. 2 of the ships were sabotaged to the point that they are not safe, or they can't sail. Fortunately, the sabotage was discovered before they were at sea, so nobody was hurt. The American boat was scheduled to leave Greece, but the Greek government has refused to allow it to sail. In fact, they have arrested the captain, charged him with a number of trumped-up charges, including felonies. He's an American from Monterey, California. And according to a Greek consulate official, they did this at the behest of the Obama administration, which had pressured the Greek government to prevent the ship from sailing.
That's very, very interesting. We haven't heard about that on the mainstream media, and the Greek government is certainly having, shall we say, an interesting time right now. What's your assessment, Professor Zunis, of how Greece has been asked or somehow enabled itself to become I don't want to call it the hitman, but why not, for either Israel or the U.S.? How did this happen to Greece, and is the financial difficulty played into it?
No doubt. I mean, historically, Greece, while not anti-Israel, has generally been more sympathetic to the Palestinians than any other European country. And they allowed ships to sail from their ports that were part of the flotilla last year. There are six ships in that case, all of which were intercepted, you know, one of which, of course, had the fatal confrontation that you mentioned in your introduction. But because they are in desperate financial situations and have been beholden to pressure, you know, from the International Monetary Fund and Western governments, they are particularly vulnerable to pressure. Now, interestingly, the socialist government is in power right now, and historically they have, you know, been willing to challenge the U.S. on a number of foreign policy issues where they found it appropriate, but this time, given their more vulnerable situation, they apparently have caved.
That's very interesting. Now, a socialist government in Europe is not certainly the picture that a lot of people have been put out by the Tea Party and others about this, we're just monstrous, evil socialism. It's quite normal there. There's a lot of...
more accurately, it would be considered social democratic. You know, not unlike the Social Democratic Party in Germany or the Labour Party in Britain, that kind of thing. But more so than those governments, the Greek Socialist Party has been willing to take a more independent line on a number of foreign policy issues, particularly particularly with the Middle East. Not surprisingly, since geographically they are in the Eastern Mediterranean and they have a lot of interactions with Arab countries. Also, in part reaction to Israel's historic close relationship with Turkey, though that was challenged, of course, by last year's incident.
And Turkey and Greece have not always been, shall we say, best of buddies. How did that...
That conflict goes back millennia.
Yeah.
But
how does that U.S., or rather Israel and Turkey break in relations? Because, I mean, it left from Turkey last year?
Yes. And Israeli commandos aborted the ship. And the crewmen, which unlike the passengers, had not gone through the required nonviolence training, fought back when Israeli soldiers board their ship. Now, according to international maritime law, if your ship is boarded by hostile forces in the high seas, you have a right to resist. I mean, I don't think politically it was smart for them to do, because the Israelis and their supporters here in the U.S., used that as an excuse to defend the attack, but nine of the Turks were killed, including one who had U.S. citizenship, a 19-year-old man, who did not fight the Israelis. He was simply filming the attack.
Yes.
He was shot, and then later murdered execution style, shot at close range in the back of the head. In fact, forensic evidence. Indicates that five of the nine people were shot close-range execution style. And so despite the murder of a U.S. citizen on the high seas, the Obama administration defended the Israeli attack. A letter signed by more than 300 members of the House of Representatives and dozens of senators also defended the attack as legitimate self-defense. The United States was the only member of the 60-member United Nations Human Rights Council to vote against a report that was based on this evidence from forensic pathologists and others that cited the fact that the majority of those killed were in fact murdered. So this was obviously quite disturbing.
Yeah.
And then what made it worse was this year the Secretary of State Clinton, when she was asked about this upcoming flotilla, she criticized it, saying it would provoke actions by entering into Israeli waters and creating a situation in which the Israelis have a right to defend themselves. Now, there are a couple things that were rather disturbing about that. One was that, why would Israel need to defend itself against an unarmed ship? In fact, the only thing that the U.S. boat, I mean, some of the boats are carrying, food, medicine and civilian construction supplies and things. And, the Israelis destroyed hundreds and hundreds of homes and businesses and public facilities in their military offensive in January of 2009, which they haven't been able to rebuild. And so some of the ships are bringing supplies to help with the reconstruction. The U.S. ship simply has letters of solidarity to the people of the Gaza Strip. who've suffered under this draconian blockade, suffered under Israeli attacks, and suffered under the rule of the this hardline right-wing fundamentalist Hamas government. So they're just simply having letters. And so Clinton is basically saying that, having an unarmed ship of Americans carrying nothing more than letters of solidarity gives Israel a right to self-defense. And the other thing is, she claimed that it was in Israel, it would be entering Israeli waters. Well, in fact, the rule of the ship doesn't, it goes well to the west of Israeli waters. Essentially, she's put the United States on record as saying that the Mediterranean beyond outside the Gaza Strip is somehow within Israeli waters, which no previous U.S. administration has done. So, in many ways, she's just essentially giving a green light for an Israeli attack on an unarmed American ship.
I'm sitting here with my jaw dropping. That seems, it's surprising, really, that A, she said it, and B, that there'd be such a lack of response to that. So that we're talking again with Professor Stephen Zunis, who is a professor of politics and chair of Middle Eastern studies at the University of San Francisco. And so this American ship carrying just letters, nothing else, no food, no construction equipment, just letters. Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State, said that the Israeli government has a right to defend itself because it's in Israeli waters, even though the waters off of the Gaza Strip are, as you say, Professor Zunis, not Israeli waters, and that they can. It's pretty amazing there. So I thought that perhaps, you know, once it got close to Gaza, that might be considered Israeli waters. That's not the case?
No. Because Gaza Strip is not part of Israel. It's a non-self-governing territory that is, you know, under Hamas administration. But legally speaking, it is not in Israeli waters. Israeli waters are, if you go to the northeast up near Ashkelon, then you're getting to Israeli waters. But the route of the boat was going to be well to the west of there. It's amazing. You're hearing people talk about it, being all these extremist pro Hamas, kind of organizations, but if you look at the groups that have endorsed it, it's organizations like Progressive Democrats of America, the Catholic group Pax Christi, Peace Action, Nonviolence International, Jewish Voice for Peace, War Resisters League, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. The people on board include the celebrated novelist Alice Walker, Israeli-American linguistics professor Hagit Borer, former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, veteran Foreign Service officer and retired Lieutenant Colonel Ann Wright, and some prominent peace and human rights activists like Medea Benjamin, Robert Naiman, Steve Fake, Kathy Kelly. Despite this, Brad Sherman, who's a Democrat, who's the ranking Democrat on the House Foreign Relations Committee Subcommittee on Terrorism, has said that these people have clear terrorist ties, and he's called on Attorney General Holder to prosecute these people for taking part in this flotilla. My Israeli friends are basically saying, there's debate, to be honest, within some segments of the peace and human rights community, both here in the United States and Israel, about the timing and appropriateness of the flotilla and that kind of thing. But the bottom line is that the Israeli and U.S. reaction is so out of proportion, so incredibly out of proportion. It's making both the Netanyahu government and the Obama administration look pretty silly, frankly.
It is kind of surprising. But you talked about the timing in particular. What is different this year with regard to the timing? Is it because...
Well, the main thing is that the siege has been relaxed.
Yes, partially because of what happened last year.
Yeah, exactly.
The bad publicity.
Here's what's really another thing that's kind of silly. Both this year and last year, people are saying, this is not about providing humanitarian goods is about provoking a confrontation. Oh, yeah, the four students who sat down at that lunch counter in Greensboro, North Carolina in 1960 were not just interested in a cup of coffee, you know? any kind of act of nonviolent civil disobedience is in part to provoke confrontation. That it is to raise awareness on a political issue. It is to put those in authority in a dilemma situation. Whether people are talking about as if that's a terrible thing. And what's also interesting, in addition to Clinton's comment, was that the State Department itself came out with a statement that basically said that
that the protesters themselves are to blame for bringing on the danger and the attacks.
Yeah, exactly. She said groups that seek to break Israel's maritime blockade of Gaza are taking irresponsible and provocative actions that risk the safety of their passengers.
Uh-huh.
Israel's maritime blockade of Gaza has been declared illegal by the International Red Cross and a broad consensus of international legal scholars. But this idea that, it's your fault if something happens to your passengers by doing this, I mean, this so mirrors the line. I'm old enough to actually remember this because I grew up in the South. You know, the line of being that, these civil rights groups are provoking these white racist mobs into attacking them, you know, so it's therefore their fault if anything happens to them. You know, it's that same kind of logic.
That is interesting, and you often hear that, women can't, especially on hot summer days where, you know, shorts and you know.
Right, provoking men from, you know.
Raping.
Yeah,
right,
exactly.
Or assaulting them, and more seems evolved minds, shall we say, would think that no, women get to wear what they want to wear, and they're not, you know, you can't blame the victim. So here these people are from, you know, certainly interested in sympathy with the suffering of the people of Gaza but different political points of view, and they are provoking a violent assault. Whatever happened with, you know, last year during the assault on the, what was the name of the boat there, in the Mavi Marmara, a 19-year-old U.S. citizen, Furkan Dogan, was killed traveling legally on international waters, and he, as you said, he was shot execution style. How can it be that the Obama administration never filed a complaint with the Israeli government? I mean, is that just another example of the U.S. just giving carte blanche to this right-wing Israeli government?
Yeah, it could be, but you know, it could be even worse than that, in the sense that, you may remember back in the 1980s, there were a number of infamous murders of Americans in Central America. You know, the four church women were murdered by the Salvadoran junta, and the young American engineer Ben Linder, who was murdered by the Nicaraguan Contras.
Yep,
and the Reagan administration, you know, never formally complained. In fact, they tried in both cases to blame the victims, to exonerate both the Salvadoran government and the Nicaraguan Contras, who, of course, were armed and supported by the Reagan administration. And I think we're seeing a similar pattern here. I think just as the Reagan administration was saying to international solidarity activists, or even people like those American nuns who are simply there to help the poor, that, you know, if you go into these countries and try to do your good works or whatever, and it gets in the way of the political agenda of our right-wing allies, we're not going to do anything if anything happens to you. You know, and it sort of served as a warning against international solidarity activists and others from spending time there. And so when you think of these groups like Peace Brigades International, Witness for Peace, Nonviolent Peace Force, Christian Peacemaker Teams, International Solidarity Movement—you know, these are folks that go into conflict zones in Palestine, Mexico, Colombia, Guatemala, El Salvador, Nepal, Indonesia—you know, kind of in places like that. basically I think the Obama administration may be trying to give a signal that, hey guys, you're on your own because these are U.S. allies, and if they do anything to you, don't count on us to come to your support, your defense.
You know, I'm perhaps a little older than you, Professor Soons, because I remember when the AFSC, the American Friends Service Committee, the Quakers, sent some aid to northern Vietnam during America's war against North Vietnam and against the southern liberation struggle as well. My recollection is, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the U.S. let them get away with it and didn't make a big deal out of it and let them bring some humanitarian aid to our alleged enemy at the time. And there was not a big deal made out of it. Was that...
I know some people who were on that ship, and they were allowed to set sail, and no attempt to stop them, despite obviously the very strong U.S. naval presence off the coast of Vietnam.
Right, right.
This is during the height of the war.
And they didn't get much attention because of it. And yet here, you know, talk about bad publicity for Israel when they attacked last year. It was, frankly, very favorable publicity for the flotilla, the peace flotilla. And so it seems that perhaps Israel has learned a thing or two instead of attacking them when they get closer to Gaza. I'm not sure how close they were to Gaza last year. But this year, it seems that the government of Greece is going along with it. Somehow, a couple of the ships, anyway, their propeller blades got damaged very severely. And this kind of sabotage, you got to be pretty good at doing things like this, and it's way off.
I had a friend who was on a boat that was on sail from Cyprus way back in the 1980s. In a kind of similar act of international solidarity, and the Israeli divers planted a bomb and severely damaged the boat and never set sail. And this is rather, rather interesting because you hear people like Obama and quite a few others saying, oh, only if the Palestinians and their supporters had used nonviolence, and only if they used nonviolent means, when the Palestinians and their supporters have gone to use legal means, the International Court of Justice, the U.S. has condemned them. When they have tried to use diplomatic means, going to the United Nations, the United States vetoes it. When they try to use nonviolent direct action, such as the flotilla, the U.S. tries to block it. So the opposition is not to Palestinian violence, per se. It's against the Palestinians essentially doing anything. I mean, just last week, the U.S. Senate unanimously passed a resolution condemning any effort by the Palestinians to seek independence, even on the 22% of Palestine of the West Bank and Gaza that is recognized by the international community as being under foreign belligerent occupation. So again, that even if Palestinians say, okay, all we want is this is 22% of Palestine, which is not part of Israel, that's all we're asking for. Senate unanimously says no. You can only have a state under conditions and with the boundaries agreed to by the Israeli occupiers. Now, replace Palestinian. If you look at a resolution, just replace Palestinian with say Namibian or Kenyan or Algerian, you would see just the colonialist mentality. I mean, this is taking us back 70, 80 years, this idea that the colonies of France and Britain, the independence of France and Britain were a given, but the independence of their colonies could only be under the conditions agreed to by the colonial occupier. And this is where our both Republicans and Democrats in Congress are saying that, yes, Israeli independence is a given, which I agree, it should be, but that Palestinian independence can only be under the terms and conditions of the Israeli government, and I'm saying that that is fundamentally a colonialist and racist mentality.
And speaking of racists, one of the leaders in the current rather right-wing Israeli government is Avigdor Lieberman, who, if you Google Avigdor Lieberman, you'll be pretty surprised at some of the things he has said that are clearly racist and colonialist.
Very much. But here's the weird thing that basically both the Senate resolution,
yeah,
but also the position of the Obama administration as well, is that if Hamas, you know, the hardline Islamist movement,
right,
is, you know, within the government of the Palestine Authority, along with the more moderate, you know, secular Fatah, which dominates it, even if they're just a minor party in the coalition, that Israel has should not have to negotiate with them, that the U.S. should sever all ties and communication and aid or anything to the Palestine Authority, et cetera, et cetera. But it's unless and until Hamas unilaterally recognizes Israel's right to exist, agrees to all previous agreements, et cetera, et cetera. And yet if you look at the coalition government of Israel, not only is Netanyahu himself refused to live up to previous agreements, like the agreement to freeze this construction of new settlements, but his coalition partners include groups that literally call for the ethnic cleansing of all Palestinians from within Israel itself in the West Bank and Gaza, and of course refuse to recognize Palestine's right to exist, et cetera, et cetera. And again, we have this rather racist double standards, you know, that putting these criteria on the Palestinian side that are much, much higher than that of Israel.
We are talking with Professor Stephen Zunis, professor of politics and chair of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco, and he also serves as contributing editor of Tikkun magazine, which, I don't know how you describe that, a Jewish peace intellectual magazine, very thought-provoking magazine. And Israel has, Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman, when it comes to the flotilla that we're talking about here, he credited its diplomatic efforts, in quotes, for the delays and setbacks that have kept the vessels grounded. He said, quote, "I welcome all the efforts that have been made to stop the flotilla." Now, that is, it sounds like Israel put a lot of pressure on the government of Greece, and there's a lot of people out in the streets of Greece right now, a lot of people really angry about the austerity measures that are coming down from on high against this, you know, the socialist government, at least in name only, government is doing the bidding of the international finance market. And I wonder how that's playing on the streets of Greece, and that, you know, has Greece become a partner of Israel in, you know, have they been forced to do that because of moneyed interests?
Well, I mean, the Greeks right now are so disgusted at their government already for giving in to the pressure of international bankers. I mean, you know, this is, you know, just like our financial crisis, you know, here, this bailout is there to serve the profits of banks,
yep,
more than anything else, and yeah, at the expense of ordinary people. And, you know, there's this great great anger at the Greek government. You had, you know, hundreds of thousands of people protesting peacefully, as well as a few thousand people who were rioting.
Right.
And, you know, these demonstrations were obviously in the headlines the past couple weeks. And now this incident, while relatively minor, I think, in the eyes of most Greeks, given the severity of the austerity programs that are about to, and selling off of public assets that are about to hit,
yeah,
in many ways is emblematic that here we have Greece, you know, the cradle of Western civilization and the oldest democracy in the world, is essentially being treated like a banana republic.
Mm.
And you know, my last name, you may know, is Zunis. I'm of a Greek background.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, it's particularly, I still have relatives there and everything, and they just see this as just, you know, emblematic of how Greece is essentially being treated as a third world country.
My goodness. And I wonder how much trade Greece does with Israel, how important Israel is as a...
I think that might be a factor, but again, as there's some folks from Jewish Voice for Peace who met with the Greek consulate in met with Greek consulate officials in New York on Friday, and the people they were meeting with acknowledged that it was actually pressure from the U.S. government that was the primary factor, because Israel doesn't have that much influence on Greece, but the United States has quite a bit.
And it does seem that Israel learned a few things from its black eye, self-imposed black eye last year, and they've kind of outsourced their naval blockade of Gaza to Greece. And I find it fascinating to learn that Greek authorities have forbidden 7 vessels from sailing, saying, well, they lacked the proper safety equipment. They arrested the crew of one ship after it left the port of Piraeus, I hope I pronounced that right, without permission. And the flotilla has been beset with what are being called bureaucratic problems and 2 cases of alleged sabotage recently. And only 4 of the initial 10 boats were in the running to make it. And so a lot of pressure is being outsourced to Greece, and so that they're not, you know, Israel doesn't have its fingerprints directly on it, but who else could do the sabotage there? They've probably denied it for all I know. I find it fascinating that the American captain, John Klusmer, was arrested when the American boat, the Audacity of Hope, the flagship of the flotilla, attempted to leave Greek waters on recently after Athens banned all Gaza-bound ships from setting sail. Now, there's a lawyer, Richard Levy, a passenger on the boat who has visited Klusmer in jail in a port town near Athens, told the U.S. activist that he had no bed, no toilet in his cell, and is receiving no food or water. We'd offered
nor any consular assistance, apparently.
Apparently so. And
which when Americans are imprisoned abroad, no matter what the charge, the people from the U.S. Embassy, come and check out the situation, make sure they're at least being treated fairly. But in this case, as of this weekend, he had not received any consular visit.
And no, he's got to have food or water at some point in time.
Yeah.
And I'm just amazed at this, that the government of Greece could be doing this, and that the U.S. Embassy in Athens is saying nothing. The government of Greece is saying nothing about this. It's like Israel's just pushing it off. They got, very bright in sabotaging the boats and using its diplomatic efforts, as Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman said. And there's very little going on about this. So Greece, as you say, it appears to be being treated as if it's a third world country. And Israel is very powerful militarily, as is the United States. Where is the U.S. government in all this? You talked about Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's comments, that they're bringing it on themselves. First, let's take a look at Congress. What is the power of the government of Israel in the U.S. House and in the Senate?
Well, this is an area of controversy. I mean, a lot of people assume that the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, and other groups that are generally associated with the Israel lobby are quite influential. And for all intents and purposes, these are mouthpieces of the right-wing Israeli government. The decisions they take are very hardline, supportive of Netanyahu and his right-wing coalition. They are certainly not representative of American Jews as a whole, who tend to be more moderate, more liberal, more progressive on Israeli-Palestinian issues than the Israeli government. Their allied political action committees, definitely have some influence in Congress. But I think in general, the power of the Israel lobby is greatly exaggerated, in the sense that at least in terms of overall U.S. policy, which is more driven from the executive branch, and Congress is more reactive. I mean, these congressional letters and resolutions are obnoxious, but they don't generally hold a force of law. But I think even more than that is that I think the failure of the mainstream peace and human rights community to take have these otherwise liberal members of Congress accountable for taking what by Israeli standards would be considered very right wing positions. I mean, I'll take an example of my own senator, Barbara Boxer, who has perhaps the most right wing record of any Democrat in the Senate when it comes to Israeli-Palestinian issues. If she was in the Israeli Knesset, she would be a part of Netanyahu's coalition based on the position she has taken vis-a-vis Palestine, Lebanon, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, Democracy for America, the liberal activist groups founded by Howard Dean, named her the Progressive Hero of 2010. Move On has endorsed her and called her a progressive hero, as they have quite a few other members of Congress who've taken similar right-wing positions. Now, again, both you and I are old enough to remember how in the 1980s, Democrats, even those who had fairly liberal records in domestic issues, if they supported Reagan's policy in Central America, we called them death squad Democrats. People like us might vote for them in November as the lesser evil, but we wouldn't, give them enthusiastic endorsements and call them progressive heroes and that kind of thing. We'd be protesting, maybe even sitting in their offices, et cetera, for supporting the Contras and the Salvadoran junta. And similarly, we didn't give much slack to people like Hubert Humphrey or Scoop Jackson on Vietnam, even though, again, they had some pretty good records when it came to labor, civil rights, and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But nowadays, it seems that these supposedly progressive organizations are giving all this slack to people with these anti-human rights, anti-international law, foreign policy positions when it comes to the Middle East. And so my view is it's not that AIPAC is all-powerful or whatever. It's that the peace and human rights community has not taken these people to task. And I think by exaggerating the power of AIPAC, it essentially becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, because you hear people say, oh, well, they can't help it because AIPAC's so powerful, so we'll call them progressive heroes and donate to their campaign and everything like that. Well, if I was Barbara Boxer or John Kerry or anybody, any other kind of liberal a Democratic senator, and I got the message that I could be as right-wing as I want on the Middle East, and I won't get any flack from my progressive base.
Right.
Of course, why shouldn't I follow AIPAC's lead? But
I suppose
I think it's less a matter of an all-powerful pro-Israel lobby as it is really a weakness and irresponsibility of the pro-peace forces to make the Middle East as high a priority as it should be.
Very interesting point of view. I hadn't heard that before, but it makes a lot of sense to just, blame AIPAC. There's nothing we can do about it. Wash our hands. But
it's certainly not anti-Semitic to complain about AIPAC and that and its clout and everything like that. But at the same time, I find it a little troubling. People will whine about the supposed power of Jewish organizations and then not mobilize themselves to challenge the policy.
Well, there is a new group in the U.S., J Street, but I'm not sure how. I mean, they're getting pretty organized, and a new lobbying group to be a bit more balanced than AIPAC, but they're starting to go somewhere. And I was remembering, Professor Zunis, during the 1980s when the Reagan administration was supporting the death squads of El Salvador and the right-wing, basically death squad Contras of Nicaragua, there were some members of Congress who did speak out. I think specifically of Massachusetts Congressman Ed Markey. And I wonder, you know, I hear that that resolution that you say has passed, that which is frankly a little bit surprising, and it seems like it's done specifically to head off the September vote in the United Nations recognizing a state of Israel. Have there been any members of Congress who have spoken out? Any Jewish members in particular?
People have been pretty quiet. I mean, there are a handful of people. Some members of the Black, not in the Senate, but in the House, you find there are a handful of members of the Black Caucus, for example, you know, Barbara Lee, for one, and some people who represent kind of fairly liberal constituencies, Jim McDermott, from Seattle, Sam Farr from Santa Cruz. Lynn Woolsey from Marin County, and mm-hmm. a few others, have taken, I think, more independent lines that are more in line with the Israeli peace movement mm-hmm. Than the Israeli government. But people really do need to make this an issue, yes. Comparable to other foreign policy concerns. I mean, I remember when I first moved to San Francisco and talked to Nancy Pelosi's district director. Yeah. He said they got 7 times more calls on East Timor than they did on Palestine, and part of it, of course, is tribute to the efforts of ETAN and other people who were working against the Indonesian occupation. But I think it's also indicative that people who are concerned about Palestine, not because they're anti-Israel, not because they are even pro-Palestinian per se, but simply because they believe in human rights and international law for anybody, anywhere.
And you, Professor Zunes, you're a professor of politics and chair of Middle Eastern Studies. If the U.S. wants to have stable governments in the Middle East, and Lord knows that there's been a lot of volatility lately in Egypt and certainly ongoing in Syria, what is the U.S. policy doing now? Is specifically when it comes to stopping the flotilla, what kind of a message does that send to moderates or pro-democracy people in say, Syria and Libya and the other parts of what has been called Arab Spring?
Well, I just got back from Cairo a couple weeks ago, actually, and I was basically hanging out with the young leaders of the pro-democracy struggle there. And they were raising these very concerns, as you mentioned. I mean, not only were they very upset and disappointed, of course, of the decades of U.S. support for the Mubarak dictatorship, but also continued support for the Israeli occupation. And these are not hardline extremists, didn't want Israel wiped off the map or anything like that, but they did want into the suffering of the people in Gaza. They wanted there to be a viable, independent Palestinian state. And U.S. opposition to this and continued support for Israel, despite its ongoing violations of international humanitarian law, was something that they virtually all wanted to talk about. And it really does hurt U.S. credibility. I mean, how can we talk about democracy and human rights and rule of law when we deny that to an entire people and spend billions of our tax dollars propping up an oppressive and illegitimate occupation when we continue to block legitimate queries and criticisms regarding Israeli violations of international humanitarian law. And this is definitely hurting America's reputation in that part of the world, and is really giving fodder to extremist groups who aren't just concerned about human rights, but who really are anti-Israel and anti-American.
Yeah, some of the more extreme measures, and we don't really want to, as you say, but we seem to be giving fodder to them. And with regard to this specific flotilla that is held up right now, that was hoping to sail off, there is the boat, the Audacity of Hope, obviously taking its name from Obama's book, And now the Attorney General of the United States, Holder, what is he saying about this? I heard something about a Holder is threatening to prosecute these peaceful, unarmed people who are just trying to deliver mail to the people of Gaza. What is Attorney General Holder talking about now?
Actually, my knowledge is he himself has not threatened to prosecute, but he has been encouraged by some Democratic members of Congress and Republican members of Congress to try to prosecute these people, as well as to deny entrance into the United States people from other countries who are part of some of these other ships, which of course include, you know, parliamentarians and musicians, actors, athletes, others. You know, it's rather pretty disturbing, to say the least.
And I wonder, what do you think? I mean, this discussion started out with, your article saying, and the evidence is clear from the comments of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, that the U.S. seems to have given a green light to Israel to do whatever it can to stop this unarmed flotilla. What do you suspect, Professor Zunis, has been discussed through diplomatic channels between the Obama and Netanyahu governments? Do you think they were that clear about, hey, you guys do whatever the heck you want? Or what's your guess about this? You've been following this for a while.
It's just really hard to speculate. And I think that's perhaps why the Obama administration apparently pressured Greece to prevent the ships from leaving in the first place, because they did not want to have a confrontation at sea. I mean, can you imagine what would happen if, say, Alice Walker got killed by Israeli commandos?
True.
Or
that wouldn't be good.
You know, there's a. I think.
So it's probably
really this is what's been happening behind the scenes. It's been. It's not as much a be between Obama administration and Netanyahu government in Israel, but
more between
the Obama administration and the Papandreou government in Greece.
And what could the Obama administration have done about this? Were they backed into a corner with regard to the flotilla?
No, the Obama administration can be very clear. They said, okay, this is a U.S. flagship with Americans on board that has absolutely no threat to Israel, that is not getting anywhere close to Israeli territorial waters, and to tell Israel no in certain terms that if you attempt to board this ship on the high seas, it'll be taken as a hostile act. And this will threaten our diplomatic and strategic relationship if you do. I mean, there is nothing stopping Obama from doing that, from saying that. But obviously, this is not the direction he chose to go. But at the same time, please keep in mind that he was getting a lot of pressure, not just from right-wing Republicans, but from many Democrats as well. The very Democrats, the groups like Move On and Democracy for America, want us to believe somehow are progressive heroes.
We are talking with Professor Stephen Zunis, professor of politics and chair of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco. There is an election coming up in these United States, and I can't help but think that Obama is looking at what might happen there. So I wonder if Obama did take that stand, as you suggest, how that might hurt his election. I frankly don't think it would hurt his election, because a lot of...
In fact, I think just the opposite. I mean, polls show a majority of Americans, including a majority of American Jews, who would actually support a more even-handed U.S. policy, one that is based more on human rights and international law, one that recognizes both the legitimate security concerns of Israel and the rights of Palestinian Arabs, and recognizes they are not mutually exclusive, but in fact mutually dependent on the other. Polls show that most Americans, including most American Jews, are take positions closer to the Israeli peace movement and closer to groups like J Street and Tikkun and others than AIPAC. So I really have a hard time thinking that Obama and these other The Democrats, including most of the elected Democrats in New England, instead of taking this hard right wing position, I think it would actually help them because, frankly, I'd certainly vote for Democrats over Republicans come November of next year. My enthusiasm, my willingness to campaign or donate money or whatever is substantially reduced if Democrats take these positions, which I see as contrary to basic human rights international law. I don't consider them too pro-Israel because I think ultimately these kind of policies hurt Israel.
Mm-hmm.
I consider them too right-wing.
Yes,
sensitive to human rights, international law, and I'm also withholding any support for groups like Move On and Democracy for America, as long as they keep endorsing these right-wing Democrats who take these anti-human rights and anti-international law positions. And so I think that it's really hurting Democrats and including erstwhile liberal Democrats, as long as they are taking the positions that if they were taking these identical positions on Central America in the 80s or East Timor in the 90s or Vietnam in the 60s, would be seen as appropriately as hawkish, right-wing, militaristic positions that would lose them support.
It is curious indeed, very curious. Now, Professor Souness, what do you think is going to happen? The flotilla is basically stuck in place. I can sense the enthusiasm that must have been on the ships when they started to take off from ports in Greece. Are they just going to fade away and disappear from the headlines? What do you think is going to happen now on the high seas?
I've been following tweets and Facebook entries and from a number of friends of mine who are on board, Medea Benjamin, Anne Wright, among others, they are a number of them actually did a sit-in outside the U.S. consulate in protest of the U.S. government's role in all this. So they were immediately arrested. The U.S. officials refused to talk to them. I think there'll be ongoing agitation within Greece. I think one possibility is that they might try to regroup and set sail from Turkey or from some other country eventually. But for now, they're struggling to free the captain from these trumped up charges, and are hoping that Greek public opinion might help sway the government's position. But given that there's mass demonstrations on the austerity programs didn't change things, I'm rather dubious that Papandreou will shift on this position either, his position on the flotilla either, especially given all the pressure he's apparently getting from the Obama administration.
I imagine so.
Otherwise.
Well, Professor Souness, one last question. What does this say about the old traditional power of nonviolent action? This is, I would think, in the tradition of the sit-ins at the Woolworth lunch counters and things like that, it is provocative.
And again, you don't have to, I think in certain ways, it's a win-win situation that because the actions by the Israelis, the Greeks, the Americans on this have been so absurd and so out of proportion that it has, in certain ways, been a victory already. I mean, it is not. I'm sure if I was one of the people on the ships, I'd be very, very frustrated. I would not be able to sail into Gaza and deliver these, letters of solidarity and that kind of thing. But on a political level, in certain ways, they've already won. Israel's been made to look bad. The Obama administration has looked really bad, and it publicizes how absurd and extreme these positions are, because this has nothing to do with terrorism. This has nothing to do with Israel's right to exist. This has nothing to do with questioning Israel's many legitimate security and other concerns. Yeah, this is about basic human rights, and so I think that like any good dilemma action, to give a local example, yes, they went ahead and built one of the Seabrook reactors, but the campaign at Seabrook raised awareness about nuclear power across the country and across the world to an unprecedented degree, and played a major role in suspending construction of these additional dangerous sources of power, electrical power. So sometimes you may losing a battle may actually move you forward in terms of winning the war.
Absolutely. Professor Stephen Zunis, thank you so much. I'm sure we'll talk again. I don't think the Middle East situation is likely to be over, unfortunately, for quite a while. Thank you so much for being with us today on The Burt Cohen Show.
Thank you.
And we will be back next week with more discussion about issues in the news. We'll see what happens to the flotilla.
All hands on deck, we've run afloat. I heard the captain cry, explore the ship, replace the cook, let no one leave alive. Across the strait, ships come home to die. No lofty peak, no fortress bold could match our captain's eye. And rode from ship to shore.